Hi there, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Vulcan Knowledge. I am joined today by Leif Karlstrom, who is a professor at the University of Oregon in volcanology and geophysics, and he is also a professional musician. Hi, Leif. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No problem at all. No, I'm very excited about this session, which is bringing together two things that I absolutely love, which is volcanoes and music. So it'd be great to hear a bit about your background and how you've been able to keep up both being, you know, a volcanologist and a geologist, as well as being a professional musician.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me, first of all. I think this is a great idea for a podcast, actually, so I hope you have a long and successful future. yeah, I guess a bit about myself. I have these sort of two lives that I've been living for quite a while now. And to a large extent, I sort of blame my parents. My mom is a professional violinist and teacher, and my dad is a professor and a geologist. In fact, I'm a third generation professional geologist in that sense. So I've kind of had these two things going for a long time, and I almost don't like to admit it because it sort of feels like I haven't really done anything new with my life, but here we are. And yeah, so I went through formal training in sort of classical music with violin in college. So I have a performance degree. I studied physics and math, was not so interested in geoscience at that point. And you know, as things happen in life, there are sort of strange circumstances that lead you to where you are, random left turns and whatnot. And I had an opportunity to do an internship, one of my final years in undergrad, with a person who ended up becoming my PhD advisor, Michael Manga at UC Berkeley, who gave me the opportunity to work on a project for summer, and I realized that this was something I really liked, and here we are.
So that was your spark into geoscience then?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I sort of had it because I grew up with it, but I never thought I would go there. In fact, I really consciously tried not to.
So slowly got steered back into the family path.
Yeah, I went into the family business, as it were. Yeah,
yeah, both of them. And so how was I keeping music along the way then?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, it's gone in fits and spurts, but it's been quite continuous. It's something that, you know, I feel like is a deep part of who I am, and I feel like there's something missing if I'm not doing it. So there are times when I do it less and sometimes when I do it more. And in fact, there was a time when I was doing it full time, sort of after I finished graduate school and prior to starting at the University of Oregon. I had a bit where, you know, doing music professionally was all I was doing. So it's, yeah, it's something that I've been developing for many years, I guess.
Brilliant. So just out of curiosity, what sort of music genre have you been involved in over the years or currently?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, I have training in classical music, and I love classical music, but that's not really what I do. I also sort of have a long love of a variety of different genres. In middle school and high school, I was in a punk rock band and I played guitar, and that's where I learned sort of how to improvise. And that has really been the direction that I've found, you know, the most fulfilling is improvisational music. And so when I was in college, I discovered bluegrass, sort of American roots music, I guess, if you like. And and that's really, I found that I really like that. Sort of combines a lot of elements that I like about improvisational music with just sort of the social element of like getting together with your friends on Friday night and playing music. And that's what you do for fun. Going to festivals. It's a really, really great sort of part of American culture, really, this kind of roots music that is very, very much about just playing with people in an informal manner.
Yeah. And you're in the right part of the country to do it as well, based on the Pacific Coast and then up into the Northwest.
Yeah, yeah, it's everywhere. But yeah, this is a good place to be. Yeah.
So on that note of improvising, I think this is a nice segue to what we're going to talk about here. One of the perhaps maybe the best improvisers we have in art is nature. or maybe not, as the case may be. So what we're now going to do is talk about one of Leaf's very exciting projects, which I've admired ever since it came out, and I wanted to showcase it on this immediately by bringing these two completely different areas together of volcanoes and music. So can you tell us a bit about the Volcano Listening Project?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess just as a bit of backstory there, I've always viewed these two parts of my life as quite separate. I mean, it's distinct communities, different languages. It's actually really hard to make meaningful crossover that doesn't feel forced and kind of cheesy or fake. But I guess I found something that I hope will get there with this recent project. I guess what the motivation for it is more or less a realization that the way that we encounter data, the way that we try to understand natural data is visual. That's how we're trained as scientists, right? You look at plots, you look at movies sometimes, you read text. It's a primarily visual throughput there. But of course, we have other senses. And just in terms of the numbers, if you want to understand, time series data and subtle variations in time, your ears are much more finely tuned to do that than your eyes, just in terms of the sensor that they represent. And of course, this is no coincidence. There's like good evolutionary reasons for, being able to sense patterns in noisy data, or being able to react to such things. And as it turns out, people have actually approached scientific data from an aural standpoint, right? By listening to it. And this process called sonification, and nowhere near as well developed, of course, as the visual representation of data, but I think quite powerful. And so that was kind of the original motivation for the project, is sort of thinking about how could we, encounter volcanic data, how could we perhaps learn from it by listening to it?
Yes,
and that opens up a whole world.
Of course, because if you're physically in the field, particularly if you are dealing with an active eruption, one of the best tools you have at your disposal, as well as your eyes, of course, is your ears. So that's listening to the sounds that we can hear. But what you're talking about is actually sonifying other data sets, not just that listening within our frequency of hearing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I guess one of the ways that I've tried to, rationalize this to myself and maybe explain it to others is like, imagine, if you will, a plot with two axes. I wish I had like a little whiteboard, but I don't. But so one axis is sort of the representation or the degree of representation of data. And by that, I mean, I guess something coming out of a sensor might be in sort of voltage counts or in ones and zeros or something like this, very raw, very hard to parse, right? And you can go from that to, looking at a plot of this, turning it into something that you can look at visually. So for example, doing this, if it's more sort of high dimensional data, you might do surfaces or make movies or something like this. And each level that you do is more sort of sophisticated representation. Okay, that's one axis of this. And I just described how that works visually. We can go through that same exercise for the sonification approach. But the other axis is interpretation. So representation, interpretation. And of course, right at the origin there, interpretation is just going to be the raw numbers, ones and zeros, if you like. That's not really that useful for most of us, even the most highly trained. And so you have to interpret it to some extent, right? Even if you're making a plot, you have to choose the color of the symbol, the size of the symbol. These are sort of arbitrary choices, actually, but lend themselves to being able to interpret things. And then, of course, you can go farther and farther along that plot, and eventually you get to like Vivaldi Four Seasons or something, right? Where it's basically like completely interpretation. Maybe you're motivated by the fact that it was spring or something, right? But there's very little about the data there. And in some sense, like I like to put that on the same axis, actually, right? Because to some degree, you are using the data as inspiration for creating art, right? So now if you look at your data in this space of representation, interpretation, you can sort of put like peer-reviewed science in some blob. You can put like education, you know, outreach, and then you can put art. And they all live in this space happily together, and they in fact overlap. And so sonification, I guess, you could think of quite generally in that way as just taking any type of data. It could be spatial data, could be temporal data, and representing it in terms of sound.
Brilliant. And not just sound as well, but then also adding those other layers on top. So like you just said, normally we see these things from a visual experience, but by adding on a visual layer to an audio data, you enhance that experience for a reader or a watcher or listener.
Yeah. And I think this is, I tend to think that this is the way that we're going, right? Is in terms of a more immersive, more multimedia approach to life even, right? But we're calling these things data movies. And I should say this is by no means at this point just me. In fact, a lot of the inspiration for this Volcano Listening project comes from a prior effort by Ben Holtzman at Columbia called the Seismic Sound Lab, where he's been developing these sort of sonification and visualization tools for seismic data and for earthquakes for many years now, actually. And there's some really wonderful data movies that he's put up. In fact, he's done big sort of exposés at the Hayden Planetarium in New York City that are really wonderful. But that's sort of the idea, is that you sort of combine a visual element, which maybe allows you to give yourself a sense of place in some sense, and some grounding in things that you're more used to interpreting as a scientist. And then the sonification element, which, you know, brings to the table a lot more in terms of the ability to sort of sense different patterns.
Yes. So particularly when you're dealing with, as you said, like time series data, you're taking, you know, but somebody can't sit there and listen to a data set for 12, 24 hours, days and weeks. So you're having to compile this data over long, long periods of time. And by doing that, you're able to potentially see these patterns through another way. So that's, as you say, taking seismic data or volcanic infrasound that we can't hear with our regular hearing. But when you bring it together over a shorter time frame, you can actually start to recognize those signals.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess we could talk about maybe the techniques of sonification a little bit, because I think in order to dig into this, take a deep dive as it were, then we kind of need to the nuts and bolts. And I think keeping in mind this plot that I laid out for you with representation interpretation is a good way of starting with this. I actually wonder whether I could, you know, I have a couple of sounds all sort of queued up here as it were. This is a sonification of an experiment actually that I was involved with in graduate school, looking at a geyser in Yellowstone National Park. So it's the Lone Star Geyser for anyone who's been there. This thing has erupted almost like clockwork every 3 hours for at least a century. Lots of people actually.
That long?
Yeah.
It's that far back?
There's a whole crew of citizen scientists, geyser gazers, that keep really good tabs on that geyser and every other geyser in the park. But this thing is like a great sort of analog to volcanoes. And we view it very much like a sort of miniature, perhaps less deadly volcano.
Yes. a lot more easily accessible and reliable.
Yeah, that's right. And that's crucial, right? Because we don't know how to predict when volcanic eruptions will happen or what happens when they do erupt. And so this allows you to sort of understand in a system that works physically in some similar ways, you know, how do you instrument, how do you monitor, how do you make sense of multiple data sets that are, it's sort of like the, you know, people within a dark room trying to look at an elephant and like looking at different parts of it. I mean, that's sort of how I view scientific instrumentation, is that like you have no idea what you're seeing there. And it's only this weird sort of remote picture anyway. So you have to find ways of kind of seeing through the noise and even seeing through the complexity to processes that you might be interested in.
Volcanology is supported by Geology for Global Development. It's a UK-based charity which champions the role of geology in sustainable development. Their aim is to mobilise and reshape the global geology community to help deliver the UN Sustainable Development Goals. You can find out more about the work of GFGD by visiting their website, www.gfgd.org, or following them on social media.
So let's see. So I guess, yeah, so just to describe the data set a little bit, I should mention that we have made these data movies, this being a podcast. I'm not going to show the videos, but presumably you can link to them or something.
Yeah. Anything that you show or that you've mentioned today, we can provide the links for. So if you're listening by audio, then I definitely encourage you all to go to the links through whatever platform you're seeing to see the full experience.
Yeah, great. Yeah. So we made a data movie, and I think a crucial element of these, which I'll talk through it so it'll be a little bit easier, but if you're kind of encountering this in the wild, as it were, you need a reference. And so sort of an explanatory key, I think, is really important, mostly because this is a type of interacting with data that we're not used to. So whether you're coming at this as an expert or as a member of the general public or something, like, you need to be able to sort of know what to listen for. So what we did is we took 10 hours of data. So that encompasses three different eruption cycles. Remember, it's erupting every 3 hours, and each eruption roughly lasts, I think, 15 minutes or something like this. And an eruption cycle at the Lone Star Geyser, as well as many other geysers, includes these very distinct phases, where one of them is the eruption, but then there are kind of like a sort of a lead-up phase, a relaxation phase, a quiescent phase. And so what we wanted to do is to be able to hear those. And we had a number of different instruments out that are actually very similar to the instruments we use to monitor active volcanoes. So we had a tilt meter measuring the angular displacement of the ground surface. We had a broadband seismometer that was looking at sort of high frequency noise associated with cavitation in the subsurface and water movement. And then we had an infrared sensor pointed at the geyser cone. And so that was going to tell you through voltage when water was coming out. So we had those three different data streams. And the goal is to listen and identify the four phases that I just mentioned of the geyser eruption cycle from those data streams.
You've compiled each of these data streams into a single sound. So they're now a single file.
Yeah. So this is like a cheesy way to think about it. It's like, some sort of like polyphonic orchestral thing, right? Where each sensor is a different voice, if you like. So what I'll do is I'll play the whole thing. I'm not going to play the entire track. I'll just give you a taste for it. But then I'll very briefly isolate each data set. Okay, so that is one eruption cycle that we just heard.
Okay, that was one cycle.
That's 3 hours. 3 hours of data. So an important component of the sonification procedure, generally speaking, is to apply speed factors, either, usually speeding things up, but sometimes slowing things down, so that they're within a range that you can sort of process. There's three different data streams that went into this, and there's four different stages of the eruption cycle. So we can talk about them. I'm doing this in part to talk about the different ways in which we approach sonification, because I think this is a nice way of doing it, because you could think of the simplest as what we call direct sonification. So again, coming back to this plot of sort of representation and interpretation. This is sort of almost the lowest level of sonification that we can do. We're literally just speeding up the seismic data until it's within the audible range. Okay. We did do a bit more processing on this. We did a polarization analysis because what we're after here is listening for actual physical movements of water from the geyser reservoir, like the sort of volcanic magma chamber, to the cone. And so if you can hear the stereo sound, I guess, yeah, hopefully you'll be able to hear that. If not, it's in the video. But this seismic data has a panning left and right that you can then listen for the movement, actually, physically, of the subsurface water. Okay, so here it is. Okay, so what you can hear is this is just the raw data in some sense, with a little bit of analysis later on top. But those sort of pulses that you hear, those are the movement of bubbles, we think, between the geyser reservoir and the cone. And those are preceding the main eruptive event.
Okay, and it's very much constant. There's always something happening, and then you get these sudden events happening within
that. Yeah, so there's a lot of noise. The Earth is constantly making noise and humming in various ways.
Water's constantly moving.
Yeah. And so, you know, of course, I guess I should mention that much like magmatic volcanoes, we actually don't understand why volcanoes or why geysers erupt. We don't understand why volcanoes erupt. We have ideas, right? We have models. And so one of the goals of this study is to actually place some constraints on the physical processes that are involved in geyser eruptions. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so that's level one. That's the seismic data. I'm now going to show some of the tilt data.
Okay.
So that's a sensor on the ground that's basically tracking the angular displacement. And this is widely used at volcanoes because we see inflation and deflation of magma reservoirs. Yeah. So what, and this happens.
But we're talking about a tiny scale here, aren't we? Just millimeters, yeah. If that.
nanoradians. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
For sure. So these are quite sensitive instruments, and so
yes.
This one, right, is a totally different type of data. So seismic data is oscillatory data. It's a waveform to begin with. So actually, you can meaningfully speed it up, and you will hear something. This is a continuous time series of data, right?
Yeah.
So we have to apply a different approach. And so again, going back to our sort of representation versus interpretation plot, this is now where we've implied something about how the, sort of sounds translate to data. So you're going to hear swelling of pitches and chords, and that's how we're representing the tilt data.
So our higher pitch is us going up in tilt.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, increasing tilt. Okay, there we go.
Yeah. Okay, and then the final one is this IR sensor data that's actually, this is the one that's tracking when stuff is coming out, when the eruption is occurring. And so we use a different type of sonification. We use an actual instrument called a granular synthesis instrument, which takes a continuous stream of data or a time series and chops it up into little sound grains. And this gives us a different texture, right? So again, we're applying layers of interpretation here and layers of representation, but it allows you to hear the patterns in a way that is quite distinct from the other types of data, and so that when you hear them all together, they mean something. Okay, so I'm going to start playing this one. And of course, you won't hear anything at the beginning because the eruption isn't happening.
Okay, nothing. Oh.
Okay, yep. So that was the sort of preceding events, and now here's the eruption. And there's the relaxation. Okay. So that's all three of them. And so now I'll play the whole thing together really quickly. And so you can hear the whole bit and hopefully listen for the interplay between these different data sets.
Yes. Okay.
All right.
awesome. It makes such a difference, as you say, having that walkthrough and listening to each of them individually, understanding what each of those signals are. And then just the fact that you've been able to take completely different physical forms of data and combine these all into a single experience.
Yeah.
That last, what did you say, how long this lasted for?
That was 20 seconds.
20 seconds listening to how many hours of data?
Oh, 3 hours of data, yeah.
3 hours of data. Wow.
Yeah.
As you say, it just completely changes the way you experience data, as opposed to just looking as you would normally do in a plot in a research paper and seeing three plots underneath each other and you're trying to track them down, matching the different signals together. Whereas there, you can just close your eyes. You could look at the visuals as well, but you can just close your eyes and listen to it. Listen for those interactions.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, the artist putting on my artist hat, of course, you know, there's a lot of value in thinking aesthetically. Right. Even if you have a very technical and objective frame of reference, because, you know, sometimes sounds can be quite distracting in ways you don't want them to be. Right. So you can basically use the aesthetics and sound design, which is, of course, its own field. Right. Movie soundtracks and commercials and all sorts of sounds that we hear in our everyday life are highly engineered. So we can use all of that, you know, framework to design sounds that allow us to pull out information. And that's the whole goal.
Brilliant. So, and so as well as the geyser, you're also able to apply this to volcanic systems. It's not as reliable or predictable, but sometimes you have events that are very well monitored, very well recorded, and you have data sets at your disposal. I guess that's the hardest part with volcanic eruptions, is you need the data available to be able to process it. And so a lot of this relies on recent data acquisition and recent monitoring.
Yeah, it does. But again, these techniques are quite general. So I think one, you know, I thought I would show another example of something that's maybe less intuitive. So we're in the process of applying these techniques to just anything. And in fact, if people have ideas, right, of data sets, we're very much in the beginning stages here of this project. So
you are all ears, literally.
all ears, yeah. But so there's a famous, now famous data set of explosive eruptions globally that I believe actually you were mentioning you contributed to a little bit, which is awesome. And it's been of enormous scientific value, right? This is sort of the best, to the best of our knowledge, this is all the eruptions that have happened. I think, well, through the last 10,000 years, but I have actually focused on a much shorter time because, well, there's some completeness issues.
Yes.
As you go farther back.
we're always trying to find older historic eruptions in the past. It's a difficult job, but the most recent window is the best observed and best recorded at the moment.
That's right. So I thought I would apply some sonification to this explosive eruption database. And, you know, I guess in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through the procedure in that. I'll just sort of show you what, you know, our latest, and this is very much in progress. So we haven't published this yet, but, you know, in this case, it's not a continuous time series. These are just events, right, where you have, you know, perhaps a composition, a volume. So that's the magnitude, like the earthquake magnitude for volcanoes is like the amount of stuff that got erupted. And it's logarithmic, like earthquakes. But then you also have things like the type of volcano and where it happened in the world. And those are all parameters that we can map onto sound, right? So you can spatialize sounds, and that tells you where the eruptions happened. You can, of course, come up with ways of figuring out magnitude and mapping, you know, different eruption types and compositions onto sound. And so this is just a taste, I guess, maybe, of that.
Okay. Well, yeah, there's at least a dozen different parameters that you could choose from this database. So, well, you've got a full orchestra on your hands if you want it, but that probably sounds like utter chaos.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, check it out.
Big eruption in there.
Some big eruptions. This is the last 600 years of eruptions.
So this is coming forward in time to present day?
Actually, it's going back in time. And actually, that's something that I think we'll probably change in the final version, is have us arrive at the present. But you can sort of, you know, and I think probably what's coming through is not the full experience in terms of the sounds that we've designed. But we've tried to be, you know, quite meticulous in some ways. And I'll just stop sharing. About, you know, sort of how you encode magnitude versus composition versus volcano type. I don't expect you to hear those things right off the bat. It would be crazy to. But with a key, right, that tells you this is what's varying along this axis versus that axis. I actually think that we might learn some things from this data movie, because the patterns that emerge are quite different than I've seen this data represented before.
And then you can start getting completely creative and assigning a whole range of instruments to every different type of data set. So. Personally, I want you to apply trumpets to the highest magnitude eruptions. But
okay, yeah. Well, in some sense, actually, one of the goals of the project is to make tools that allow anyone to mess with this. So, if you want trumpets, you know, you should make one with trumpets. And these are not standard tools that we are, you know, that have in our toolbox. But I've started, and Ben Holtzman and others have run workshops and classes teaching sort of from a sort of programming standpoint, how do you sonify data? And hopefully it becomes a thing that becomes part of our normal workflow. Yeah.
Yeah. So going then the next step and taking that sonified data and actually producing scores out of it that people can physically play. Although I don't even want to know what some of those look like.
Yeah, no, it's we're actually making a score from this eruption database. Yep. So there's automatic notation software. It's quite sophisticated, really, and it would be more like a percussion score. But that's actually the other stage of this project, is that there is an artistic, you know, purely aesthetic component to it, which is that we're taking this data and now having musicians interpret it, right? So either try to play it faithfully, like play that volcano explosive eruption database. It's possible, right? That's you would take some work, but a skilled percussionist could definitely play that. But then you can, you know, take it another step and ask people to compose based on it, or to improvise based on it.
And that's all going back to that graph.
It's all going back to this graph, is that, you know, and maybe what you want to interact with in terms of volcanic data, you know, maybe you don't necessarily care about the data itself, or even the interpretation. Maybe you're just inspired by the patterns that you see or hear.
Yeah, so you can follow the data for a while, take on that inspiration, and then break out into a full jazz solo in the middle of the database if you want to.
if that's what you want to do, yeah. And I think, you know, like much art, right? There's a long tradition of doing this, right? And so I hope that this opens up a new way of people making sort of art and music too.
Awesome. That's a really, really nice way to wrap up the project. The other one that I wish we had more time to show, but I'll just direct everybody to go and watch it, is your full audio visual experience of Hotel Kilauea. So this, if I'm correct, is taking several data sets from the 2018 eruption of Kilauea in Hawaii and visualizing it visualizing the data as well as the sound data. So it's the seismicity, the GPS movement, the tilt data, mm-hmm. and anything else?
There's gas emissions.
And gas emissions. Brilliant. So yes, I encourage everybody to go and have a listen and a watch of Hotel Kilauea. For anything related to this project, you can go to volcanolisteningproject.org. I believe you're also on Twitter as well, at Volcano Listener. So you can follow along with Leaf and his group's work. And so I just want to wrap this up now, as I do with everybody, just to ask you, what's your most memorable volcano-related experience?
I think there's many. Of course, volcanoes are quite memorable, whether they're erupting or not. But I did have the sort of luck to get to visit Halemaumau while it was still quite an active lava lake. So I visited actually only a few months before the 2018 eruption, when the lava lake went away and there was that large eruption on the East Rift Zone. And so I visited in a, you know, in a scientific capacity, and got the chance to visit the routine sort of morning monitoring sessions with the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory led by Don Swanson there. So we had to get up at 3 a.m. You know, this is before the park opens because, of course, it's off limits to visitors. And they have a number of sensors, including physical collectors of tephra that are being sort of updated. And so we go out there and, you know, it's the middle of the night and you see this sort of very ominous looking glow. And, you know, I think I would say the experience, of course, it's a rather spectacular thing, seeing a volcano in its sort of full eruptive state. But I think the experience, especially with regards to this, is the sounds.
Yes.
Very deep rumbling sounds like felt through your entire cores. Like as soon as we were close enough, and especially when you sort of got out of the car and started walking towards the crater's edge, you know, you hear it way before you see it. And it's this sort of very deep rumbling that, you know, is the convection in the lava lake, more or less.
And then there's just that constant crackle as well when you're close in the background. So you just start adding all of these layers and then eventually you get the visual experience.
Yeah. And it's quite wonderful. So I think that, you know, if I needed any other reason, that's a pretty good one to start on this path.
Fantastic. Well, I say there is, I'm sure, plenty more that we could talk about, and it's really, really incredible work that you're doing, which is just bringing a new way for people to observe, analyze, and interpret data. Whether you are, as you say, a specialist in the field, or you're coming into this from the general public. So thank you for the work that you and your collaborators are doing in this project. Thank you, Leif, for coming on today. I really, really appreciate it. And we will see you all next time.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Volcanology, hosted by Sam Mitchell and produced by Hugh James with Anturus Education. This series was supported through the American Geophysical Union's Sharing Science Program, and you can catch more of our episodes and information on our guests on our website, www.volcanology.com, or follow us on social media at Volcanology through Twitter and Instagram.